24. The Aftermath. In the Great Library at Jumpy, there is a tapestry that is rumored to contain a map through the mountains to the Rain Wilds. Like many Jumpy maps and books, the information contained was considered so valuable that it was encoded in the forms of riddles and visual puzzles. Figured on the tapestry among many images are the forms of a dark-haired, dark man, stout and muscular, and bearing a red shield, and in the opposite corner, a golden-skinned being. The golden-skinned creature has been the victim of moths and fraying, but it is still possible to see that in the scale of the tapestry, it is much larger than a human, and possibly winged. Buckkeep legend has it that King Wisdom sought and found the Elderling's homeland by a secret path through the Mountain Kingdom. Could these figures represent an Elderling and King Wisdom? Does this tapestry record the path through the Mountain Kingdom to the Elderling's homeland in the Rain Wilds? Much later, I learned how I had been found leaning against Burridge's body on the tile floor of the steams. I was shaking as with an ague and could not be roused. Chong Kui found us, though how she knew to look in the steams I will never know. I will always suspect that she was to Eod, as Chade was to Shrewd, not as assassin, perhaps, but as one who had ways of knowing or finding out almost anything that happened within the palace. However it was, she took command of the situation. Burridge and I were isolated in a chamber separate from the palace, and I suspect that for a while, no one from Buckkeep knew where we were or if we lived. She tended us herself with the aid of an old manservant. I awoke some 2 days after the wedding. 4 of the most miserable days of my life were spent lying in bed, limbs a-twitch, but not at my command. I dozed often, in a deadened way that was not pleasant, and either dreamed vividly of Verity, or sensed him trying to skill to me. The skill dreams conveyed no sense to me, other than that he was concerned for me. I grasped only isolated bits of knowledge from them, such as the color of the curtains in the room he skilled from, or the feel of a ring on his finger that he absently twisted as he tried to reach me. Some more violent jerk of my muscles would shake me from my dreams, and my spasming would torment me until, exhausted, I dozed again. My periods of alertness were as bad, for Burridge lay on a pallet in the same room, breathing hoarsely, but doing little more than that. His features were swollen and discolored, such that he was barely recognizable. From the beginning, Chong Kui gave me little hope for him, either that he would live, or that he would be himself if he did survive. But Burridge had cheated death before. The swelling gradually subsided, the purpling faded, and when he did awaken, he proceeded to recover himself swiftly. He had no memories of anything that occurred after he took me from the stable. I told him only what he needed to know. It was more than it was safe for him to know, but I owed it to him. He was up and about before I was, though at first he had times of dizziness and headaches. But before long, Burridge was getting to know the Jumpy stables and exploring the town at his leisure. In the evenings he would return, and we had many long, quiet conversations. We both avoided topics where we knew we would disagree. And there were areas, such as Chade's teachings, where I could not be open with him. Mostly, though, we talked about dogs he had known, and horses he'd trained, and sometimes he spoke, a little, of his early days with chivalry. One evening, I told him about Molly. He was quiet for a time and then told me that he'd heard the owner of the Bee Balm Chandlery had died in debt, and that his daughter, who had expected to inherit it, had gone to live with relatives in a village instead. He did not remember what village, but knew someone who would know. He did not mock me, but told me seriously that I should know my own mind before I saw her again. August never skilled again. He was carried from the dais that day, but as soon as he recovered from his faint, he demanded to see Regal immediately. I trust he delivered Verity's message. For while Regal did not come to visit either Burrich or me during our convalescence, Ketriken did, and she mentioned that Regal was most concerned that we recover quickly and completely from our accidents, for as he had promised her, he had forgiven me completely. She told me how Burrich had slipped and struck his head, trying to pull me from the pool when I went into a seizure. I do not know who concocted that tale. Jonqui herself, perhaps. I doubt if even Chade could have come up with a better one, but Verity's message was the end of August's leadership of the Coterie, and all Skilling, as far as I know. I do not know if he was too afraid after that day, or if the talent was blasted out of him by that force. He left the court and went to Withywoods, where chivalry and patience had once ruled. I believe he became wise. Following her wedding, Ketriken joined with all of Jampe in a month of mourning for her brother. From my sickbed, I was aware of it mostly as chimes, chantings, and great burnings of incense. All Rurisk's possessions were given away. To me, Eod himself came, and brought a simple silver ring his son had worn, and the head of the arrow that had pierced his chest. He did not say much to me, except to tell me what the objects were, and that I should cherish these reminders of an exceptional man. He left me to wonder why these items had been selected for me. At the end of a month, Ketriken set her mourning aside. She came to bid Burrich and me a swift recovery, and to bid us farewell until she saw us at Buck Keep. The brief moment of Skilling from Verity had eliminated all her reservations about him. She spoke of her husband with a quiet pride, and went willingly to Buck Keep, knowing herself given to an honorable man. It was not for me to ride alongside her at the head of that homeward procession, or to enter Buck Keep, preceded by horns and tumblers and children ringing bells. That was Regal's place, and he put a gracious face on it. Regal appeared to take Verity's warning to heart. I do not think Verity ever completely forgave him. But he dismissed Regal's plottings as if they were nasty, boyish tricks, and I think that cowed Regal more than any public reprimand could have. The poisoning was eventually blamed on Raud and Severins by those who knew of it. Severins had, after all, obtained the poison, and Raud had delivered the gift of apple wine. Ketriken pretended to be convinced that it was a misplaced ambition by servants on behalf of an unknowing master. And Rurisk's death was never openly spoken of as a poisoning, nor did I become known as an assassin. Whatever was in Regal's heart, his outward demeanor was that of a younger prince graciously escorting his brother's bride home. I had a long convalescence. Jonqui treated me with herbs she said would rebuild what had been damaged. I should have tried to learn her herbs and techniques, but my mind could not seem to hold things any better than my hands could. I actually remember little of that time. My recovery from the poisoning was frustratingly slow. Jonqui sought to make it less tedious by arranging time for me in the great library. But my eyes wearied quickly and seemed as prone to trembling disorders as my hands. I spent most days lying in my bed, thinking. For a time, I wondered if I wanted to return to Buck Keep. I wondered if I could still be Shrewd's assassin. I knew if I returned, I would have to sit down table from Regal and look up to see him at my king's left hand. I would have to treat him as if he had never tried to kill me, nor used me in the poisoning of a man I had admired. I spoke of it frankly one evening to Burrich. He sat and listened quietly. Then he said, I cannot imagine it will be easier for Ketriken than it would be for you, nor for me, to look at a man who has tried to kill me twice and call him my prince. You must decide. I should hate to have him think he had frightened us away. But if you decide we are going elsewhere, then we shall. I think I finally guessed then what the earring signified. Winter was no longer a threat, but a reality when we left the mountains. Burrich, Hans, and I returned much later to Buckkeep than the others, for we took our time on the journey. I tired easily, and my strength was still very unpredictable. I would crumble at odd moments, falling from the saddle like a sack of grain. Then they would stop to help me remount, and I would force myself to go on. Many nights I awoke shaking, without even the strength to call out. These lapses were slow to pass. Worst, I think, were the nights when I could not waken, but dreamed only of endlessly drowning. From one such dream, I awoke to Verity standing over me. "You're enough to wake the dead," he told me genially. "We must find a master for you, to teach you some control, if nothing else. Ketrickin finds it a bit peculiar that I dream so often of drowning. I suppose I should be grateful you slept well on my wedding night, at least." "Verity," I said groggily. "Go back to sleep," he told me. "Galen is dead, and I've put Regal on a shorter leash. You've nothing to fear. Go to sleep. And stop dreaming so loud. Verity, wait." But my act of groping after him broke the tenuous skill contact, and I had no choice but to do as he advised. We traveled on through increasingly unpleasant weather. We all looked forward to getting home long before we arrived there. Burrich had, I believe, overlooked Hans's abilities until that trip. Hans had a quiet competence that inspired trust in horses as well as dogs. Eventually, he easily replaced both Cobb and me in the Buckkeep stables, and the friendship that grew between Burrich and him caused me to be more aware of my aloneness than I care to admit. Galen's death was considered a tragic thing at Buckkeep Court. Those who had known him least spoke most kindly about him. Obviously, the man had overstrained himself, for his heart to fail him so young. There was some talk of naming a warship after him, as if he were a fallen hero. But Verity never recognized the idea, and it never came to pass. His body was sent back to Faro for burial, with all honors. If Shrewd suspected anything of what had gone on between Verity and Galen, he kept it well hidden. Neither he nor even Chade ever mentioned it to me. The loss of our skillmaster, with not even an apprentice to replace him, was no trivial thing, especially with the red ships on our horizons. That was what was openly discussed, but Verity flatly refused to consider Serene or any of the others Galen had trained. I never found out if Shrewd had given me over to Regal. I never asked him, nor even mentioned my suspicions to Chade. I suppose I didn't want to know. I tried not to let it affect my loyalties, but in my heart when I said, "My king," I meant Verity. The timbers Rurisk had promised came to Buckkeep. They had to be dragged overland to the Vin River before they could be rafted down to Ter Lake, and thence down to Buck River to Buckkeep. They arrived by midwinter and were all Rurisk had said they would be. The first completed warship was named after him. I think he would have understood that, but not quite approved of it. King Shrewd's plan had succeeded. It had been many years since Buckkeep had had a queen of any kind, and Ketrickin's arrival stirred interest in court life. The tragic death of her brother on her wedding eve, and the brave way she had continued despite it, captured the imagination of the people. Her unmistakable admiration for her new husband made Verity a romantic hero even to his own folk. They were a striking couple, with her youth and pale beauty setting off Verity's quiet strength. Shrewd displayed them at balls that attracted every minor noble from every duchy, and Ketrickin spoke with intense eloquence of the need for all to band together to defeat the Red Ship raiders. So Shrewd raised his monies, and even in the storms of winter, the fortifications of the six duchies began. More towers were constructed, and folk volunteered to man them. Shipwrights vied for the honor of working on the warships, and Buckkeep Town was swollen with volunteers to man the ships. For a brief time that winter, folk believed in the legends they created, and it seemed the Red Ships could be defeated by sheer will alone. I mistrusted that mood, but watched as Shrewd promoted it, and wondered how he would sustain it when the realities of the forgings began again. Of one other I must speak. One dragged into that conflict and intrigue only by his loyalty to me. To the end of my days, I will bear the scars he gave me. His worn teeth sank deeply into my hand several times before he managed to drag me from that pool. How he did it, I will never know. But his head still rested on my chest when they found us. His mortal bonds to this world had broken. Nosey was dead. I believe he gave his life freely, recalling that we had been good to one another when we were puppies. Men cannot grieve as dogs do, but we grieve for many years.